listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A beautiful Monday after the holiday weekend. And I hope you had a great Thanksgiving and happy Hanukkah and all that sort of thing. It's interesting collection and collage here as we go into the holiday season, how things are adding up and working out. John Boehner has told us that the House of Representatives between now and the first week of January is going to work 7 days. nice work if you can get it, I guess. it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens. Bernie Sanders, of course, is part of that conference committee that's trying to work out a budget. And Bernie Sanders versus Paul Ryan, it's going to be very, very interesting. But there are also, in addition to, you know, just what's in the news, and we'll be, getting into that in more detail as we continue on through the show. There are also some interesting issues out there, and one of them, and this reappears on this show constantly, and it always surprises me. It doesn't always surprise me. Actually, I guess it makes a certain amount of sense that people would think that way. People call up and they say, you know, we need term limits. These bums have been in there too long. And of course, that was the Republican mantra going on the third and certainly the fourth presidency of Franklin Roosevelt. Professor Jonathan Zimmerman is on the line with us. He's a professor of education and history and the director of the History of Education Department at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University, and Steinhardt, steinhardt.nyu.edu is the website. And Professor Zimmerman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You have written a piece basically saying, let's go back to the way it was before, by and large, the Republicans established term limits after the Roosevelt presidency. The Franklin Roosevelt presidency. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I want to go back to the Founding Fathers. Mm-hmm. And the Founding Fathers debated this question quite vehemently. And obviously, there were strong opinions on both sides, but they decided not to limit it constitutionally. And I think that they were right. And their major argument was that it removes, well, power from the voters, and it also takes away the incentive, they thought, for what Governor Morris of New York called good behavior. Why should the president behave in accord with the popular will if the populace is not going to be voting thumbs up or thumbs down on him?
Of course, at that time, at the time of those debates, there were not well-developed political parties. And you could argue that now
there was lots of partisanship.
Right? No, but my point is that you could argue that right now, if President Obama were to suddenly just go off in some totally weird direction as a lame duck president, that it would cause so much harm to the Democratic Party that he would be restrained by that. And that was not something that was anticipated at the time of the Constitutional Convention. In fact,
that's actually a really interesting point. I mean, I think that there's something to that, but I would also say that, you know, One of the problems with term limits, to use the word restraint, is it takes away some restraint on the governing party or the members of it to line up behind the president. And I think that we've seen that in recent months. Look, when the president and John Kerry announced their Iran deal, you can expect people like John McCain to object. But if Obama wasn't term limited, would Bob Menendez and Chuck Schumer be objecting? I don't think as loudly. And the reason is that, you know, he, the president, would remain their standard bearer. And in a certain way, once he's term limited, he isn't.
Yeah. No, I actually totally agree with your position. And I have said on this program numerous times that I have two problems with term limits. One, we already have them. They're called elections. And two, that and this probably has more to do with Congress than with the presidency. But I do think that there is some element of this that you see in the presidency. And we certainly saw in the third term of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. And that is that there is a, you know, when somebody comes newly into an office, they kind of stumble around for a while, and there needs to be you know, the wise elders who have been there and have been around who can kind of help them. And I guess in the role of president, there isn't so much of that. But in Congress, if we were to term limit Congress, and this is what we've seen in the various states where the House and Senate are term limited, that permanent infrastructure, that the wise elders who show people where the levers of power are, ends up being the lobbyists.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think that there's this very naive idea that if we term limit people, that somehow, you know, they'll be more beholden to the people and less beholden to lobbyists. But I think at the state level, there's some evidence suggesting that it's precisely the inverse.
Right. So when exactly, forgive my not having looked this up in my little pocket constitution here, when exactly did we amend the Constitution to term limit the presidency, and what was involved?
In 1947, there was a huge Republican majority in Congress which voted in favor of the amendment. But, of course, to amend the Constitution, you've got to send it to the states. They have to ratify it. So it wasn't ratified until 1951, near the end of Harry Truman's presidency.
Wow. Wow. And at that point, there was nobody who seriously thought Truman was going to be running for a third term, was it?
No, but it's interesting that as soon as the Republicans won this, and it really was a Republican maneuver, every single Republican member of Congress voted for the 22nd Amendment, straight party line vote. Right. And the Democrats who supported it were really Democrats that had broken with FDR and the New Deal. It really was a referendum on Roosevelt. But what's fascinating is that as soon as the Republicans win it, some of them start to doubt it. And the doubters include, yes, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Right.
On the eve of being reelected in 56, obviously for the last time, because now that the amendment is kicked in, he's term limited, Eisenhower makes a statement. I'm going to quote it directly because I just wish all the term limit doubters would listen to this. He said, this is Eisenhower, the United States ought to be able to choose for its president anybody it wants, regardless of the number of terms he has served. I have got the utmost faith in the long-term common sense of the American people. I take the Eisenhower position.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with it. The flip side of that, though, is the Berlusconi situation. I mean, what do you do? You know, we arguably no longer have a constitutionally limited democratic republic. We have a constitutional monarchy. The Supreme Court, through the doctrine of judicial review, you know, Marbury versus Madison, they have taken onto themselves more power than any of the monarchs of Europe. You know, the Queen of England does not have the power to strike down laws or to establish policy like money is speech and corporations are persons. Is it not inconceivable that now that money is speech, that somebody like Silvio Berlusconi, who owned more than 90% of all the media in Italy, could ascend to the presidency and then use that wealth and power to become a perpetual president?
Look, it's not impossible, but I think the answer to that lies in creating a new system for the way that we hold and pay for elections.
Right.
The answer is not to tie our hands behind our back prima facie and say we can't vote for X person or we can only vote twice.
No, I agree with you, but I don't see that. The Supreme Court is not going to let that happen.
An absolutely central one for our democracy, but I don't think the answer to the problem of democracy is less democracy.
Right. I agree. So really the problem that I've identified is money in politics, and which I'm pointing to the Supreme Court with that. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. You know, and you know, I think that our politics is broken because of the influence of big money.
Yeah.
But term limits is not a reasonable solution to that problem.
Right. I agree. I think this effort to move to amend.org, to amend the Constitution, to get around the Supreme Court's assertion that, you know, the money is protected by the First Amendment and the corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment, seems like at least a starting point. But
Possibly so, but at the end of the day, you know, we the people have to give ourselves maximal decision-making power, and the way to do that is to allow ourselves to vote for anybody that we'd like.
Amen. Okay. Professor Jonathan Zimmerman, Professor of Education and History and Director of the History of Education Program. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. Thank you, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew Campbell on the line with us, the senior producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, as always. So we're going to open up with my talking back to the right-wing trolls. I'm not even sure I'd call them conservatives. Some of the trolls over on Alternet who were trashing my recent article suggesting that a company that can't pay its workers at least a living wage should not be allowed to be a company in America.
Yeah, and a lot of those comments centered around the conservative readers of the article saying that America is a capitalist country and that that notion of paying a living wage or facing the death penalty is not something that goes with the nature of a capitalist country. But you're really going to be talking back to that and saying that America is not, in fact, a capitalist country. We are a democratic republic.
Right. Or arguably a constitutional monarchy with the Supreme Court. But that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. And then from there, we're going to talk with Dana, is it Libelson?
It's Dana Libelson. She's a reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, and she's written this great piece entitled, I Tried to See Where My T-Shirt Was Made, and the Factory Sent Thugs After Me. She went in an investigation in India. She wanted to see where a piece of clothing she had was made. And it's really just an amazing story, the lengths to which these the companies that own these sweatshops and factories go to make sure the consumer really is left in the dark.
Right. And then, of course, the reason that these factories are doing this on behalf of at least American companies is because of our crazy trade policies, which leads to our next guest.
Right. We're going to have Lori Wallach on. She's always great. She's the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and we'll dissect Dana's story, but get into how we can work around things like this, how we can stop having our consumer goods made in third world countries where the workers are paid next to nothing and really can't survive.
Yeah. And then we're going to get into a topic that on this radio show we talked about last week for a little bit, but we're going to do it on TV tonight with David Selig, and that's toy guns.
Yeah. Viewers might know the story. It happened in the end of October, but 13-year-old Andy Lopez was killed in Santa Rosa, California. The police officers that shot and killed him claimed that he was carrying a gun that looked like an AK-47. Well, that gun turned out to just be a regular toy gun, and he was shot and killed for that. And this isn't an isolated incident. This has happened across the country.
Right.
So at least in response to the Lopez case, Democratic lawmakers in California are introducing legislation that would strictly regulate toy guns and make a toy look like a toy. And we'll get David's take on that and see what he thinks.
Yeah, it just makes perfect sense to me. And then in our Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yeah, Everything You Know Is Wrong, we're going to be talking about the real strong relationship between man and dog. Everyone knows that the dog is a man's best friend, but we're going to get into the real science behind that and why dogs love us so much.
Right, and we promise not to bring Rick Santorum into the conversation.
We'll try to leave him out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll try to leave out Mitt Romney. And,
there you go. And our daily take.
We're going to be talking about how the banksters are once again up to their old tricks and setting up the crash of 2016.
Yeah, and boy are they. They've got a whole brand new way to do it. It's just absolutely amazing. Andrew Campbell, thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Oh, in fact, I'm quite sure they're not. Anyhow, Peter Schiff is with us. We heard earlier in the first segment of the program from Professor Jonathan Zimmerman at New York University, historian, suggesting that the 22nd Amendment, which term limits the president to two terms, was something that was probably not such a good idea, that the founders had argued, debated, and rejected, and that Dwight Eisenhower, when he was running for president in 1956, and he was certainly not facing term limits, himself came out and rejected, said it was basically preempting the democratic prerogative of the people to have whoever they want representing them. Peter Schiff is on the line with us, libertarian financial advisor, author and host of the Peter Schiff Radio Show. That's Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, radio.com. His website is Twitter, at Peter Schiff. And Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So I understand that you think that term limits for the presidency is a good thing, and I'm curious what your thoughts on term limits in general.
Well, you know, the founding fathers certainly had nothing against placing limits on democracy. That was the whole intent of the Constitution. The founding fathers were not fans of democracy at all. That's why they established the Republic the way they did, and it was very undemocratic, the way it went about.
For example,
if you look at the senators were appointed by the state legislatures. They staggered the terms of senators.
But the state legislators were elected. That's democratic. That's small d.
Right, but then they appointed. They didn't elect the senators.
Right.
The president and the vice president were not elected directly by the people. They were elected by the Electoral College, which was a much more deliberative body than it is today. They actually, you know, there actually was some, you know, you didn't really know who was going to win based on, you know, an election. They staggered the terms of the senators because they only wanted a third of the Senate to run every 2 years, because they wanted to further, you know, insulate them from any popular sentiment that might envelop the country. And of course,
I think that would further integrate them with popular sentiment, because it means that every 2 years, a third of the Senate is facing the voters, even if indirectly via the states.
Right, but they didn't want the whole Senate to go up for election at any one time. That was the point. Like, the whole House goes up. Because the House was actually the only body at the federal level that was.
Okay. So are you suggesting that the founders didn't, that some of the founders, and you're right, some of the founders didn't trust democracy. John Adams was probably the most prominent among them.
I mean, not true.
I mean, read Thomas Jefferson's arguments. He was not at the Constitutional Convention, but he wrote some fairly passionate letters to James Madison on the topic, about, you know, the direct election of the president and about the election of senators. Among others.
If you read all the quotes around down the line about the evils of democracy, they called it mobocracy. You know, that's why it was set up as a republic. And if you look at voting, even on a federal level, the states at the time of the Constitution all had property taxes, poll taxes, literacy tests. I mean, you know, there are lots of restrictions.
Actually, not all of them did.
You couldn't vote until you were 21, first of all. You had to be male, and you had to be 21. There were all sorts of things that they did.
Peter, respectfully, you're wrong. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you have to be male in order to vote. The 21, I'll give you that. There were women who were voting at the time of ratification of the Constitution, particularly in Delaware. There were African Americans who were voting. There were even Native Americans who were voting in some of the states. Most of the restrictions that came in that you're describing came in after 1800, not before 1800.
But they might have been on the state level. It wasn't on a, and so the Constitution prohibited it. But even when you were 21, I mean, back then, most men, you know, or women for that matter, but by the time you were 21, but certainly if you were a man, you've been working for 5, 6, 7 years. So a 21-year-old back then is probably almost like a 30-year-old today, you know, as far as, you know, how long you've been in the workforce.
So are you suggesting that this somewhat dystopian view of democracy that you're characterizing some of the founders as having had is what we should be hewing to, that we should move away from democracy, that we should undo the 17th Amendment, for example?
Well, the reason, the founders would have rather had a monarchy than a democracy. I mean, they were very nervous of democracy.
Peter, go back and read the debates, James Madison's debate, notes on the debate.
The Eliot debates.
Then when Alexander Hamilton got up and argued that the president should be elected for life, because a monarchy was better than a constitutional presidency, he was so humiliated, he was so laughed out of the room that he left and went to New York for 3 weeks and refused to come back. His feelings were so badly hurt.
The people were in favor of a republic doesn't mean they were in favor of democracy. You know, so even, you know, Benjamin Franklin's famous quote is, "What have you given us, Mr. Franklin? A republic,
if you can keep it." Yes,
and, right. And what he meant is, if you can keep it from becoming a democracy.
But see, a democracy, first of all, there's a certain amount of politics with those two words. You know, Madison invented the distinction between the two in the Federalist Papers, and then later, during and after his presidency, uninvented that distinction and said that he had basically created that distinction in order to sell the Constitution, number one.
Well, the word democracy is not in the Constitution.
No, it's not.
Every state a Republican form of government.
That's correct.
I mean, Woodrow Wilson started talking about it, but, you know,
But, you know, that was because the Greek democracy required 6,000 people to show up. It was a lottery system. It was the demos, the idiota, were the people who didn't show up to vote. It was like jury duty. You know, they were not trying to create that. But these two words, I mean, you know, it was in the 50s and the 60s, during the McCarthy era, in the 50s in particular, that it became very popular to say we live in a republic, not a democracy. That's not the point. The point is, why would you want? Well, we've run out of time to talk about term limits.
As far as why would I want term limits? I want a citizen legislature, which was the initial intent of the framers, was that people would go to Congress for a few years and then leave. Not that they would.
That was not their intent.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really.
That was not their intent. John Quincy Adams not only went to the legislature, then he ran for president, then he went back to the legislature.
Well, just because Quincy Adams did it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Peter Schiff, Schiff Radio, S-C-H-I-F-F, radio.com. Peter, thank you for dropping by.
Sure.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And term limits. I mean, there's actually a lot of things going on. I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second on term limits. I know some of you wanted to talk about these, some of the issues around these. But other things that I think are worth noting is that more than 1,500 protests on Black Friday took place at Walmart stores around our country. This is not a story you will be hearing in the corporate media, I'm guessing. I haven't, frankly, turned a television on in 3 or 4 days, so I don't know. I can't authoritatively say what the corporate media is reporting, but last year's Black Friday strike only involved 400 people. This time, 1,500 protests, and the workers' right group Our Walmart doesn't have an exact count yet, but it's substantial. So. And for 30 years, the minimum wage hasn't been high enough to lift people out of poverty. This is just tragic. If the minimum wage had kept track with the pay of the top 1% since Ronald Reagan became president, the minimum wage right now would be $22 an hour. And, you know, that actually might not be unreasonable if we had a reasonable trade policy here in the United States. But whatever. I mean, you know, there's Congress and the president are proposing $10.10 an hour. And actually, the president was proposing $9 an hour. Congress is proposing $10.10 an hour. Whatever it is, we need to get there. Also, some activists are saying that Massachusetts might be the next state to legalize pot, recreational pot. This is beyond just medical marijuana. This is going to be on the ballot in 2016. It's already right now. It's a civil offense. They basically decriminalized it back in 2008, but it's a $100 fine, and so they want to do away with that. And so it's interesting. So some of the stuff that's going on. Your thoughts on term limits, though, Kate in Hackensack, New Jersey. Hey, Kate, you had an opinion on
this. You're so absolutely right about this, because the inequality of it all, we actually defeated Obama in a sense when we elected him, because there we have the Supreme Court. What is with the appointments for life?
Yeah.
I mean, that should have been, if they were going to do that kind of thing, they should have limited it across the board.
Yeah.
I mean, we're having a lot more trouble with the Supreme Court than we are with presidents. And then on the other side, you have the Senate elected for 6 years. You know, what's that about?
Mm.
And then we have the Congress, you know, running over and over again, because they have to keep running every 2 years. They have to have more and more money to finance their life.
Right.
So they're really not our House of Representatives at all. They're representing anybody that can get to contribute to their campaign.
Right. I don't disagree. And I lay the responsibility for 70-80% of this at the feet of our monarchs, our kings and queens, who call themselves the justices and associate justices of the Supreme Court. And
yes, and it's because Roe, that's how, where people keep saying, well, why can't Obama do what Roosevelt did? Well, because Roosevelt, no matter what, there was always a threat he would run again.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah.
That,
and it's a threat, by the way, that he took.
Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah. If they turned it around, if all of a sudden there was a movement to repeal the 22nd Amendment, you would see, I mean, the Congress, I think they would all march out and shoot themselves.
I think that it would be really interesting. You know, there's these Tea Partiers who are talking about repealing the 17th Amendment, which is going back to appointing senators by the states rather than having the citizens of the states elect them. And then there are, of course, these efforts to have both senators and the president elected on a district-by-district basis in the states that have been heavily gerrymandered by the Republicans. I mean, there's all these efforts, basically, in my opinion, to limit democracy. And I ask the question, what's wrong with more democracy? I think we need more democracy in the United States, not less. Kate, thanks. Excellent point. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve.
Tom, I'm biting my tongue now, agreeing with you, but I would come up with a different scheme, okay. And that is that when you get your paycheck from your employer, you put 100% of that paycheck in a savings account, monitored by the General Accounting Services or the IRS, and then you fill out your paperwork on April 15th, and then the IRS has that length of time from April 15th till October 15th to find fault with your paperwork. Only, you know, 5 or 10%, a very small percentage, would be audited. And then on October 15th, you write a check out to the state, the federal, and the local. And in November, about the first of the month, you go and vote. After you've written a check for everything,
right.
Then you find out exactly who is responsible for you either not having enough welfare or not having enough percentage of your earnings.
Yeah. Steve, I understand your logic and the debate that was originally around payroll withholding, because the idea was that, in fact, the way that the income tax work during the Civil War was, you know, once a year you made a tax payment, and people were not real pleased with Abraham Lincoln over that, and or Andrew Johnson for that matter, which is why I think it got put, you know, it got ended. But and the whole thing of withholding is so that people don't realize how much tax they're paying. Although I think on April 15th people figure it out. I don't think the Americans are that stupid. But your argument, I get it that your theory or your desire is to try to restrain government spending or reduce government spending, but how does that happen when, you know, half of our government spending right now is our military, and it's basically untouchable? You've got large parts, you know, the NSA and our, you know, our intelligence budgets that not only are untouchable, but they're invisible.
You make the military the 13th and 14th grade. In other words, you directly force the military to train the people who go in there. If you can go into a college, go into a college. But if you can't get into a college, you join the military, and they give you marketable skills. On a very direct.
So you're calling for a draft?
No, not a draft. It's a completely volunteer thing, but occasionally you may have to rise up and go around the world and shoot people. But pretty much what we're trying to do now is shoot less and less people
using more and more drones. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's but like my brother-in-law was in the military, and he was the one who landed that satellite, or he was one of the team, I'll put it that way, for the Ball Corporation, landed that satellite on an asteroid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is, you know, went through the whole training, and we need somebody to, keep our new electronic devices accurate, so that was his specialty in the military.
Right.
And I don't see why we don't go ahead and use have the military as an armed college that we can train people to be safe with guns, understand the purpose of guns, is not to stand out in the middle of the streets and go Cisco and Poncho on people, which is, you know, I had a friend of mine that was put in jail for just that very offense.
Yeah.
You know, firing guns into the air. That's not what you use them for.
No. No, and in fact, when that happens in places like Egypt, typically 10, 20, 30 people die from bullets falling out of the skies and hitting them in ways that puncture their skulls. But, you know, back to the military and the military as a training force. Why not? I mean, two things come to mind. One is using the government as the employer of last resort, right? This was FDR's idea. FDR, when he came into office, 34% of Americans were unemployed. I mean, you had a third of America that was unemployed. And he said, we're going to make the government the employer of last resort. We have sort of done that with regard to our military, but in order to do it, we had to have a couple of wars. I mean, George Bush, in order to stimulate the economy, I'm not saying that he did it to stimulate the economy, but it had that effect. You know, his wars in Afghanistan and Iraq brought hundreds of thousands of people into the military who might not otherwise be there, paid them, stimulated the economy thusly, also, you know, all the contractors and everything. Why not just do a draft? I mean, why make it, you know, why the pauper's army, you know, to use Jefferson's phrase? What's wrong with the draft?
Well, in other words, why have a draft when you can in essence have people volunteering? In other words,
because the poor will volunteer and the rich will avoid the draft, and everybody should serve their country.
Well, it's not working that way right now because a lot of the rich people go into the military because of patriotism, because of...
I don't think our military is made up of rich people. In fact, right now, I don't think that there are more than a small handful of members of Congress, and I'm not even sure that there's more than two or three members of the United States Senate, which is the Millionaires Club, who have any members in the military. I mean, the military is largely made up of the poor in the United States, tragically. Steve, we're out of time. It's always good talking with you. Thank you for a thought-provoking conversation. We'll be back. It is 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with more of your thoughts, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And that's very interesting. In 1947, this is Jonathan Zimmerman wrote this. In 1947, Senator Harley Kilgore, Democrat from West Virginia, condemned a proposed constitutional amendment that would restrict presidents to two terms. He said the executive's effectiveness will be seriously impaired as no one will obey and respect him if they know that the executive cannot run again. And, you know, I think that that's an interesting and important point, that if President Obama could run for a third term, Congress would be behaving very differently, especially the Democrats in Congress. And frankly, I think the president might be behaving quite differently, too. This term limiting thing seems to me like not a good idea. I mean, we know from our experience at the state level, it's not a good idea because it adds power to the lobbyists and diminishes power, takes away power from people who might want to run for legislature. But beyond that, well, Johnny in Lamarck, Texas has some thoughts on this. Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You wanted to disagree about the draft?
My entire childhood was colored by the Vietnam War experience.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1971, I was 12 years old, and that war was starting to wind down. And we had another 4 years to go before it came to an official halt with that helicopter being dumped into the bay, a big waste of taxpayer money. I don't think that a military draft equates any service among everybody. People can get out of the draft. They've done it before. They would do it again. I would much rather see universal non-military service. How about we require all citizens to give at least 3 or 4 years of their life every 12 or 18 years for a total of, let's say, three bundles of 4 years, for a total of 12 years, in which they do things like maybe acquire skill as they help build homes for elderly, or paint or install roofing materials or solar panels, stuff that helps the economy, helps build up our infrastructure, and makes them feel good, and they get a paycheck for it from the government, because you know damn well private industry doesn't do it unless the CEOs can profit from it big time.
Right. Well, first of all, that's going to be fairly disruptive. And Johnny, when I'm suggesting a draft, I'm not suggesting a military draft necessarily. I think that we should do it the way that what I saw when I lived in Germany in the 80s, I don't know if they still do it that way now or not, but what a lot of European countries did, and I believe, I could be wrong about Israel, but in any case, a lot of European countries did, which is when you graduate from high school, you give a year to your country, and it can be in the military, or it can be volunteering in a hospital or some appropriate nonprofit, and then at the end of that year, you get to go to college or to trade school for free. So you give a little, you get a little, and then you get out of the trade school. And I think it provides that important transition point where people they have a rite of passage. I think that's just a psychologically necessary thing, too. So, Johnny, thank you for your call and your thoughts. Appreciate it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Texas. We'll be right back. So should we end the presidential term limits? It's an interesting one. I also want to talk to the conservative trolls who are, you know, all over me about this piece that I did last week here on this program, and also, you know, published, I think Alternet published it, that it's time for us to say to business people, enough already. If you are not able or willing, if your business model is so bad you can't afford to pay people a living wage, or if your CEOs and stockholders are so greedy you're unwilling to pay someone a living wage, you have no right to do business in the United States of America. So, anyhow, Isaiah in Chicago. Hey, Isaiah, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? I was surfing the Internet, and I was searching Barack Obama and first black president,
mm-hmm.
and a name came up.
Hello? Isaiah, I did not drop you. Sometimes people, you know, are talking on the phone, and in their enthusiasm, they hit the hang-up button. Feel free to give me a shout back. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi.
Hey, David.
I was just thinking about it, the corporations are people thing.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to have corporations or people, and what they need to do is they need to get written permission from each employee of the corporation. And then if they want to have, for permission for them to speak, the company to speak for them. So
mm-hmm.
that's the idea that the Republicans are giving, is that, you know, they're speaking for the employees.
Well, that's how it works with a union. I mean, it's not every member. It's more than 50%. But before a union will take any kind of political position, it has to be approved by their membership, and unions have to segregate any money that they use for political action from their normal funds. And any member of the union who disagrees with the way that the union is using that political funds money can get that money back from the union. And so you can say, okay, you know, I kicked in $100 to the union political fund this year, but the union has decided to you know, do thus and so, and I don't like it. Give me back my $100, and the union has to do that or not withdraw it and not take it out in the first place. So that's pretty close to democracy in the workplace. Unfortunately, only about 6% of the American workforce, the private workforce, is represented by a union here in the United States. So.
Oh, I understand that. That's what I want. That's what I want them to. If they want to, I want them to make an amendment to the Citizens United thing.
Mm-hmm.
That in order for them to use that, they have to have written permission. The corporation has to have written permission from each employee, and then a portion of their paycheck approved by the employee can go towards, you know, whatever things that the corporation wants to fund. You know, whether it be a congressman or a senator or whatever.
Right.
And then. You know, if they make it as an amendment, then we do it through our government system as well. So we do it democratically and put it in there and amend it.
Hmm.
That'll really get the Republicans in a uproar, I'm sure.
You'd almost have to amend the Constitution because the Supreme Court would almost certainly knock that down as being inconsistent with their doctrine, you know, in Citizens United. But I get it. You know, it's an interesting idea. David, thanks for the call. And thanks for sharing that with us. Isaiah, you want to try it again?
Yes, I'm back with you. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I do. You were checking President Obama and the first black president.
And the first black president, and the name John Hanson came up. And that name, basically, they said that he was not only the first black president, but he was the first president of the United States under the Articles of Confederation. Which, after that, 6 or 7 more presidents before the actual Constitution took place. So I want your thoughts on if you know about that, and also if you do know, if the public knew at large, would you think that society would act differently or accordingly?
I don't know. I do know that we had several people who were president, who had the title President of the United States before George Washington, when we were operating under the Articles of Confederation. And we don't think of them as presidents because we date the beginning of our modern country to the ratification of the Constitution in 1789. And so it was the years between the time that we ended the Revolutionary War, and I forget which year it was, and 1789, that we had, you know, the Continental Congress, and every year when they met, they elected a president, and that president had virtually no power. That president was basically the president pro tem of the Senate. He was the guy who gaveled it in, kind of thing, and he was a parliamentarian by and large, as opposed to the modern day president. Now, whether the first guy, and I know that there were at least three of them, and I used to know their names, I've never heard that any of them were African American. But
yeah, he was more by descent.
Interesting.
And just take a look at it if you get a chance, if you remember it. I just found that to be interesting about John Hanson, you know, because that would change, would shake up history a little bit. We don't hear too much in the history books about that, so that's all.
Yeah, well, you know the saying, you know, history is written by the victors. We don't hear this is like, you know, this movie 12 Years a Slave. Look at how long it's taken, you know, for you know, the genuine horrors of slavery to make it into popular culture in the United States. What the Native Americans went through, you know, the horrors, the genocide, the Native American genocide is largely ignored as well. And I believe that there was another fellow who was president of the United States whose name we would all remember or recognize. I don't remember his name, who it was argued at the time had enough African-American blood in him that he qualified as African-American by the standards of the Confederate States. But that was an issue that was in debate at the time.
That may be the guy who I'm talking about then.
Yeah. I think this was like, you know, one of the guys who was president in the pre-Lincoln, but, you know, in the late first half of the 18th or of the 19th century. But I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while. Isaiah, thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to have to do some digging on this one. I appreciate the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, I just want to, you know, lay this out. As the low-wage worker movement in the United States continues to grow, and that is as in low-wage workers saying, you know, I've had enough and I'm not going to take it anymore, damn it. It's becoming obvious that many Americans don't understand anything about basic economics. I know this from personal experience. The other day, I wrote an article for Alternet.com arguing that, or Alternet.org, whatever it is, arguing that any company that refuses to pay its workers a living wage should get the axe. They should get the corporate death penalty. And almost as soon as that article went online, the economically ignorant took to the message boards to bash it. And two comments that really stood out as representative of just how misinformed most people are about economics really popped out. One was by Terrellyn Meritz, whatever. I mean, these are pseudonyms, so it doesn't matter. He or she said, quote, "This is a capitalistic country. Running a business is a right in a free capitalist country like ours. If we made such stupid laws as saying they must offer full-time jobs when they do not want to, or that they must pay what some outsider decides is a living wage, they will simply go into business online and move their physical business overseas to a place where they face no such control." End of quote. Okay, this is so full of confusion and misinformation and just basic economic ignorance that I need to break it down. First of all, America is not a capitalistic country. We are a constitutionally limited democratic republic. Representative Democratic Republic. I mean, learn some basic civics and economics. Capitalism is one of many forms of economics that we practice in the United States, but we are not a capitalist nation. You have socialistic parts of the United States, the U.S. Army, for example. So socialist that they provide health care, they provide clothing, they provide food, they provide housing, they provide everything. I mean, it's like the ultimate socialist entity, the U.S. Army. We have worker-owned co-ops, which are, they're not really communist because they're not run by the government, but they're a form of, well, they're not a form of capitalism. Or you could argue that they're a form of capitalism where there is no capitalist or where the workers are the capitalist, but whatever. You know, the word capitalism appears nowhere in our Constitution or our founding documents. Nowhere. People are running around going, America's a capitalist country. No, we're not. We're a democratic republic. And if you're unhappy with the Supreme Court, we're a constitutional monarchy. Okay. Second thing that this bozo said in his or her comment is that running business, it's a right. You have the absolute right to run business in America. Well, yeah, if you want to run a business in a way that does not involve the commons whatsoever, which is damn near impossible. But if you want to run a business that uses any of the things that I'm going to list in just a second, that's a privilege. For example, using a stable currency and a stable banking system. I'm paying for that with my taxes so that, you know, you and I and anybody else who wants to run a business can run a business. Have a predictable and fair court systems and laws about the, you know, the rules of business. To have transportation, electrical, water, septic, communications infrastructure, all paid for by we the people. Businesses have access to all these things at no cost. Well, the cost that they have is taxes, but most big businesses in America pay little to no tax. In fact, most businesses, more than 90% of businesses in America, pay no taxes. Part of the privilege of doing business is you get a criminal justice system to enforce the rules of the game of business. And you get a workforce educated at the public expense and protected with a public pension called Social Security. So there you go. Now, another thing that this person said is that, well, if you just force people to pay a minimum wage, then they're going to move their business overseas. Well, yeah, actually, we've seen a lot of that. We've lost 50,000 factories in the last decade, or decade and a half, since 2000. But that would not have happened if we had rational trade policies like we had from George Washington until Ronald Reagan. I mean, if we simply said, no, you don't have to like go all authoritarian and say, no, you can't run your business overseas. You do it very simply. You say, fine, you want to open a factory in India or buy from a factory in India and put your brand on it and, you know, pretend that it's an American brand. Cool. When that product hits the shores of the United States, we are going to tax you. It's called a tariff. An import tax. Another commenter, Vay, had something to say about my alternate piece. Vay said, wondering what that living wage would be. Why not $50? No matter how high you go, more talented workers will demand an equal raise. Yes, you get to feel all fuzzy inside for helping the working people and yet personally benefit from your efforts, both monetarily and self-righteousness. Truly, prices would rise to offset most real gains, and many, especially the unemployed, would just suffer from the runaway inflation created. Doing businesses is a right, my good fellow. It is called freedom. Actually, Vay, you're wrong. So, you know, what is a rational bottom point? You said, you know, why don't we just make $50 the minimum wage? Well, there's actually, you know, there's historically, I don't know if you've got the audio, Shane, of this, Teddy Roosevelt talking about a living wage. We can play it in the next segment. We'll get to it. But Teddy Roosevelt laid out what a living wage would be. Teddy, not Franklin, Teddy, the Republican Roosevelt, back in like 1905 or something when he was president. He said it should be, it would vary, you know, from place to place around the United States. So it makes sense that states would establish minimum wages, but there should be a federal basic minimum. But he said it should be enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living, a standard high enough to make morality possible. This is Teddy Roosevelt's language. In other words, you don't have to steal to eat. It must be enough to provide for education and recreation. In other words, to send your kids to school and to take a vacation every year, to care for immature members of the family, to take care of the kids, to maintain the family during periods of sickness and to permit a reasonable savings for old age. Here's Teddy Roosevelt saying it.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible, to provide for education and recreation, to care for immature members of the family, to maintain the family during periods of sickness, and to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
There you go. Teddy Roosevelt. Recorded by Thomas Edison himself, by the way. I mean, you know, back in the day, right? And so that's a minimum wage. That's your living wage. And I think, you know, in today's dollars, that's at least $10 an hour and probably in most parts of this country, considerably more than that. Here in Washington, D.C., probably 15. This was the suggestion made to Walmart. With regard to your point about my being feeling warm and fuzzy about, you know, helping raise the wages, that it's got nothing to do with feeling warm and fuzzy. It's about making an economy that works, and that makes a nation that works. And in response to your point about prices and inflation, prices would not rise. CEO salaries and dividends would decline. Read your history.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When we come back, let me inform you about what causes inflation. People don't understand this. You raise minimum wage, it's going to be inflation. No, it's got nothing to do with it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, Richard in Calumet, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Well, I heard something here recently. Some friends at a local business here showed me this FEMA plan that they've got going to break up the country into six sections, and that they want to kick everybody out of the Gulf Coast so that they can build the world's largest oil refinery and shipyard, and that the BP oil spill was basically done on purpose, and the dispersement spray was told to be by the EPA to stop spraying because it's so toxic. And BP basically told the government to stick it in their ear.
Yeah.
It was on Jesse Ventura had a show on with Mike Papantonio on it, too,
yeah,
about this whole issue. And I saw it this weekend.
Huh.
And it kind of blew me out of the water.
Well, you know, Jesse's famous for his conspiracy theories and rather proud of them. And some of them are quite out there. And Jesse will be the first to tell you that. He's not. In fact, I had a nice conversation with Jesse Ventura about 2 weeks ago about the Kennedy assassination, and he said, I have no idea who killed Kennedy. He said, I just know it wasn't Oswald. And so when you're characterizing Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theories, be careful, because it may not be that he actually said what you just said. He might have said, you know, there are folks who are saying this, or maybe this is a piece of that, or maybe that's a piece of this, because Jesse's a little more rational than that. Or do you think that?
Well, these guys showed that they're friends of mine, showed me something on the internet, and they went to a secure site to show me.
Right.
And
that doesn't make it real.
I suppose you're right.
I mean, you can create anything on the internet. I mean, we own the Small Penis Gun Club. You know, we started that on the internet. And I'm serious. It's like, you know, back when Wayne LaPierre was doing his whole thing and he was ranting and raving about guns and waving around and stuff. And I said, you know, I wonder. And so we literally, we got the domain smallpenisgunclub.com and we created it, or .net or whatever it is. It's out there. It doesn't make it real.
Yeah, but I was, like I said, it kind of gave me a little more idea that there might be something true to this, was the fact that Mike Papantonio was on there.
Yeah.
Reading some things about
this
actually wanting to depopulate the Gulf Coast so that this industrial plan can go on.
Well, they are, you know, if the Keystone XL pipeline goes all the way down to the Gulf Coast successfully, and it looks like it almost certainly will now, it is going to render large chunks of the downwind, you know, the eastward direction from that area, more and more toxic to human life and other forms of life. And having the oil spill as a way of depopulating the Gulf doesn't make any sense to me.
What about the disbursements and them telling them to stop?
Corexit? Oh, they put the Corexit on. That was fairly obvious. They didn't want anybody to see the oil, right? What Corexit does is it makes the oil sink to the bottom, and so it makes it less visible. And I think both the government had an impact, had a desire to hide that, and I think so did BP. That's I'll give you a conspiracy there. But who knows? I honestly don't know, Richard. That's an interesting thought. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing. We'll be back. Yep, if you're in D.C., that's tomorrow night over at Politics and Prose. It's going to be a lot of fun. You can check all the details over at TomHartman.com. Okay, Another one of the things that, you know, this argument that was thrown at me when I suggested that we should raise our minimum wage, or that if a company can't at least pay a reasonable minimum wage, they have such a bad business model, they shouldn't be in business, is that minimum wages are inflationary. And they're not. What causes inflation is a shortage of things. Let me say it again. Arguably, you can say, okay, inflation is caused by massive numbers of dollars, right? Like the Germans, you know, hyperinflated their currency. But that is so rare and so almost impossible to do. I mean, there was actually a shortage of German marks. You know, they could not afford to pay for the Treaty of Versailles. So that shortage of German marks caused the hyperinflation in Germany, you could say. The inflation of the 1970s, for example, that hit Jimmy Carter and hit Ronald Reagan, that was caused by the Arab oil embargo. It produced a shortage of oil. So when you've got a shortage, and because almost everything in America is made out of oil, oil is like the essential commodity, that shortage tracked through the economy. It just trickled all through the economy. So we had inflation as a result of the Arab oil embargo and the resulting increase in the cost of oil. It had nothing to do with printing money or not printing money. And then finally you say economic activity between individuals is a right, but if you want protections from liability, which is what a corporation, you know, your limit of liability is your investment, that's it. If you want protections from liability, if you want to use our courts, if you want to use any of that other business infrastructure that I went through that rant just a few minutes ago, if you want it, then business is a privilege. I mean, learn some basic economics and civics. I know it's easy to dismiss this kind of misinformation as just your usual internet trolling, but I think that's a mistake. I guarantee you that if you walked into any bar in any city in the United States and started talking about a living wage, you would hear the same sort of stuff. Oh, it's inflationary. Oh, why not set it at $50 an hour? Oh, it's, companies will just go overseas. I don't know if it's because people have been brainwashed by Fox News or they just don't know any better, but the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of Americans don't understand basic economics, and the right-wing media knows this. And that's why on Thursday, when fast food workers in hundreds of cities across the country walked off their jobs to demand a living wage, the right-wing media churned out hours and hours of anti-worker propaganda filled with the same sort of misinformed rhetoric used by the commentators on my alternate article. And that rhetoric is nonsense. And Thursday's strikes, however, are far from nonsense. They're the real deal, the logical conclusion of 32 years of failed Reaganomics that's turning our country into a third world banana republic. I mean, there's just no other way around it. Bill, in St. Helens, Oregon, you have a bit of trivia about the Articles of Confederation?
Yeah, Hey, Tom, sorry, I had to get you off speakerphone.
That's quite right.
Article 5 of the Articles of Confederation, no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years.
Hmm.
Apparently, they believed in term limits, and what's interesting is most of the articles translated directly over to the Constitution, but for some reason not that one. But real quick side point, the biggest problem I see with the lack of term limits is seniority has become a spoil system. And you get people in there that, you know what, if my congressman's been in there for 20 years, I'm going to vote for him again and again and again, not because he's the most qualified, but number one, because he's the only choice I'm going to be given for my party, and number two, because he can do things well beyond the power of authority that any senator or representative should ever have by virtue of the fact he's just been there so damn long.
That he's become like a committee chairman sort of thing.
I mean, secret holds in the Senate. I mean, they've got so many rules. I think it would just go away if we didn't have people homesteading, you know, Congress for life. What's really interesting, if you look at the age of majority, I think when the Constitution was written, the average lifespan was like 47, and you had to be like 35 for president and, 30 for Congress. I'm kind of like, we assume Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, there's no limit for Congress. The average lifespan is that's very misleading. I mean, how old was Jefferson when he died? He was pushing 80. John Adams was pushing 80. Yeah, George Washington was pushing 80. People lived into their 70s and their 80s regularly. These life expectancy numbers that are often cited of A, around the time of the Constitution, or B, of when Social Security was invented, they're reduced because of infant mortality, because a lot of children died of a lot of easily preventable diseases now, and B, because we didn't have the kind of sanitation we have now, so things that are, you know, easily prevented, but a lot of women died in childbirth. So and that was in part because of the war on midwives, frankly, because, you know, these doctors they had a pretty filthy practice, basically. Their hands were dirty and all kinds of awful stuff. But people did live to a ripe old age back then. You know?
Well, I just find it hard to believe that the intent was that senior statesmen, you know, be in their homestead in these offices for life. And I would,
but a lot of the founders were politicians their entire lives.
Oh, I think that's why the term limits didn't make it from the Articles of Confederation into the Constitution, because I think a lot of the same people were voting. They saw the writing.
I think they saw it as noble work. You don't think that I'll give you, in an era where money is the same thing as speech and is protected by the First Amendment, you know, because of our Supreme Court, that we've got a problem. But, you know, if we could set that aside, if we could strip money out of politics and do away with the revolving door, and we've tried to do both, by the way, at various times, and Congress, I think, is in favor of doing both. It's just the Supreme Court stops them. I think, you know, serving politically would be an honorable and thing, and I think that there was a time when it was. Bill, I appreciate the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more on term limits and Articles of Confederation and the news of the day and minimum wage. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very mucilaginously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good. Bay State repeal. Marijuana is already decriminalized in Massachusetts, but come 2016, it could become completely legal. We're talking about recreational pot. That's because activist group Bay State Repeal is working on a campaign to make legalization a question on the 2016 ballot. If the campaign succeeds, it would make Massachusetts the third state after Washington and Colorado to legalize marijuana. While 2016 is still a long way off, things are looking good for Bay State Repeal's legalization efforts. Massachusetts voters handily approved decriminalization in 2008, and last year okayed 35 medical marijuana dispensaries. Man, if this all works out, the green monster could take on a whole new meaning. The bad. The Republican National Committee, the GOP's organizing wing, finds itself embroiled in controversy today after it tweeted out a message Sunday honoring civil rights activist Rosa Parks. The tweet, which was apparently sent in good faith, said, Today we remember Rosa Parks' bold stand in her role in ending racism. That's right, people. Racism ended the moment Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat on December 1, 1955. The RNC has tried to cover its tracks by saying that its Rosa Parks tweet was misworded, but let's be honest, most people in the Republican Party probably do think racism ended with Jim Crow. I mean, how else could Mitt Romney think it was okay to sing Who Let the Dogs Out in front of black Florida voters in 2008?
Who let the dogs out?
All right. And the very, very ugly Republican lawmakers. If you thought the birther movement was crazy, just check out this video put together by Climate Desk that shows Republican senators and congressmen using the Bible, yes, that Bible, to debunk global warming.
Genesis 8:22 that I use in there is, as long as the earth remains, there will be springtime, harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night. My point is, God's still up there. And this is the arrogance of people who think that we, human beings, would be able to change what he is doing in the climate is, to me, outrageous.
The second verse comes from Matthew 24. The earth will end only when God declares it's time to be over. Man will not destroy this earth. This earth will not be destroyed by a flood.
I would point out that if you're a believer in the Bible, one would have to say the Great Flood is an example of climate change. And that certainly wasn't because mankind had overdeveloped hydrocarbon energy.
Well, maybe not. That was Joe Barton, by the last guy. I think Jim Inhofe was in there. And anyway, these are not Taliban clerics. They are your American elected representatives. And that is just very, very ugly. So, very strange stuff. Just very strange stuff. A story, I mentioned this last week, and I think it's worth re-mentioning. And I'll pick up your phone calls here on some of the things we've been talking about today. But this was in the Financial Times. And they were basically saying, Claire Jones, Sam Fleming in London, and Robin Harding in Washington, saying the economic system of the world is so fragile that it's being held together by the U.S. Fed giving money to the banks by buying $40 billion a month worth of treasuries and $45 billion a month worth of, quote, toxic assets. In other words, basically a $80 billion a month charity program from the Fed to the big banksters. And this is the opening sentence of this article in the Financial Times. The European Central Bank on Wednesday issued a stark warning over the threat posed by the scaling back of U.S. monetary stimulus, calling on Eurozone policymakers to do more to prepare for the market shocks from Federal Reserve tapering. The Fed could taper as early as December. In other words, we don't have an economy here in the United States anymore. We have banksters running things. And, I mean, it just gets very, very bizarre. Anyhow, Chuck in Bartoloso, Illinois. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you always meant to pronounce that. It's Bartelso.
Bartelso, thank you.
Yes, in that video mashup you were just playing, one of the other guys, and it's over in Raw Story, is John Shimkus. He's actually my congressman, and he cites the Bible as proof that the global warming is not real.
Right.
And I'm frankly embarrassed that he's my representative. But, you know, you talk about people that are uninformed with respect to economics.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I live with.
Yeah.
These people that are so profoundly dumb that they vote for him.
Well, and this is a problem all across the United States, is that people don't understand economics, and they don't understand it until it, you know, just really, really gets in their face. And it's been, I don't know, it's just been way too long. You know, since before Reaganomics. I mean, Reagan came along and he had his Lafler curve and his supply side economics, and it all sounded so good, sort of. And the average person said, "Oh, well, he must know what he's talking about. He's president, and he's got all these advisors around him. And look at that. He like, you know, the economy. We had horrible inflation, and unemployment was bad, and we had the biggest stock market crash since 1929. All this happened in the first 4 years of the Reagan presidency." And then things got good. Well, things got good because Reagan tripled the national debt. I mean, you give me a $3 trillion credit card, I'll show you what it looks like to live large. Reagan engaged in stimulus spending that, frankly, Franklin Roosevelt would have been embarrassed by. And he would have been embarrassed by it because it basically just went to Reagan's cronies. It didn't go to the working people of America. But so did Shimkus run on term limits?
Yes, he ran on a platform of term limits in 1997. He said he would serve no more than 12 years. He's still there.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that with us. Bud in Yellville, Arkansas. Hey, Bud, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Yeah, you know, your last couple of comments about the ignorance of people pretty well exemplified your gentleman's. I think he had the same idea. The term "too much power, too long" breeds contempt. And if you have people in power that long, I'll take, for example, I voted both sides, independent, Republican. McCain was my hero for years, mm-hmm. until I saw him turn after he got blackwashed by his party. And he pretty well is a wimp anymore politically. And mm-hmm. he goes along with his party, period. He used to be a person that you could depend on going for the right.
Well, sort of. Remember the Keating Five? I mean, McCain is a political survivor. McCain did what was necessary.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. But when he first came in office, I think he was more of a fighter for every just thing he believed in.
Yeah.
And as it went along, he just got buried in his party buried him.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And that's my personal opinion.
And now he's just the old guy who's yelling, "Get off my lawn."
I agree.
Unfortunately.
The only defense we have against ignorance is putting a stop to some of this power.
No, I completely disagree, Bud. Term limiting members of Congress is not going to make the voters smarter. It's going to make the lobbyists more powerful. The cure for ignorance is information. We need to be teaching people things.
There's plenty of information out there. People just don't want to accept it. They take the BS and put it in their brain, and it's all over.
Well, there are people who are committed to promoting that bat guano that you're talking about there. You find that in right wing talk radio, and you find that over on Fox News and things like that. But I just don't see how you can think that term limits are going to somehow fix things. I mean, we have term limits. They're called elections.
No, the bottom line is, in essence, I would agree with you if you had the majority of people that weren't ignorant.
Yeah.
I live in Arkansas. I came from California. So I've had a rude awakening as to what who I've got to deal with, what I've got to deal with. Yeah. And I just see things differently now. It's the only defense we have. You have those people, there's some people who have never, it's like this gentleman was just saying about his congressman and the Bible. How long has he been there?
Yeah.
And it's 15 only because
years.
Of the ignorance of his state. And bottom line, for the people that really believe in democracy and justice, is that you have to have some way to get these fools out of there.
Well, you know, I think part of the problem, Bud, is that the 32 years of Reaganomics has done what it set out to do. Back when Reagan became president, you had the strongest and most well-informed middle class, arguably, in the history of the world, certainly in the history of the United States. And now you've got families where people, you know, two and three people are working in a family, and people are working two, three jobs, and people just don't have the time to even bother reading a newspaper, assuming one's available. You know, Carl Wolfson, my friend Carl, was on the show the other day from Portland talking about how the Oregonian, the statewide newspaper in Oregon that I used to read every day, which is published by a New York family, by the way, right, conservative New York family, has now gone to either 3 or 4 days a week. I mean, it's not even a daily paper anymore. So it's like people don't even have access to information except from places like Fox News and you know, right-wing radio. I mean, it's pretty scary. Bud, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need an economy run by the consumer. How do we get that? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Bobby in Granbury, Texas. Oh, that.
Yes.
Hey, Bobby, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Just great. Just great.
I was listening to the discussion about global warming, and let me just say to start with, I think that whatever we do, we need to make sure that our air and our water are as clean as possible, and that we don't contaminate our earth with terrible stuff that we can't get rid of. So I agree with that part. As far as man being responsible for global warming, or global cooling, or climate change, or whatever the new thing is each year when the other one doesn't come about. If you look back in history, we have some very good records in Greenland. And in 800, 900 in Greenland, they were raising wheat and corn and livestock and pigs, and people were outdoors most of the year. and I didn't have to protect the cattle except in the coldest part of the winter.
Bobby, that was a local phenomena. I realize that you've probably been listening to one of these global warming deniers.
No, you're
absolutely right. Greenland did have a little summer period there for a few decades. And in all probability, down in Tierra del Fuego, they were having the exact opposite. This was a local phenomenon, not a planet-wide phenomenon. Local weather is irrelevant.
So the fact that we didn't have summer in the United States in the 1700s, that's a local phenomenon.
Well, that was a planet-wide local phenomenon in as much as it was caused by – you're talking about when the volcano went off?
Right. I'm talking about the time period that we went through, the little ice age, and we went through the dark ages in Europe. We had a total climate change.
Well, we had 1 year where we in Europe had a pretty bad summer because there was a volcano, but then you've got that little ice age period, and then you've got the little warming area. Those are local phenomena. They're local phenomena. Those are not global phenomena. You're going to see weather patterns change around the planet. This is a natural thing.
And they have ever since the planet has been here.
Sure.
It changed drastically.
Sure, but not planet-wide. Not planet-wide. We are looking now at a planet-wide change. The pH of the oceans has changed. The temperature of the deep waters of the oceans has changed. The temperature of the atmosphere, there's 5% more moisture in the atmosphere now than there has been since humans basically appeared, evolved, whatever, 165,000 years ago. 400 parts per million.
You don't have any way to know how long it's been. You can figure from the time that we've been able to keep records. But if you look back in the past, and that's the very biggest weakness of your argument.
No, well, actually, you can look back in the past, Bobby. You can drill into 600,000-year-old ice cores in Antarctica and in Greenland, and you can pull out the air bubbles from those ice cores, and you can see exactly what the concentration of gases were at that time. You can look at areas where plants have died and turned into bog or turned into fossils, and you can see this is not rocket science, Bobby. This is simple, straightforward stuff. The people, I'm telling you, you need to really look at the science. The people who are telling you that because you could grow grapes in England or in Greenland at one point in time in the last couple thousand years means there's no such thing as global warming, they are lying to you because they represent a $1 billion industry and they're very well paid. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Goats for the Old Goat is the only .com animal group that gives you a photo of your goat and the recipient, and that's at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And hey, Victoria, how are you?
Hey, Tom, I'm fine. Thank you. Yourself? I hope you had a wonderful holiday.
I did. We visited with some other orphans around us, people who were stuck on their boats and didn't have family nearby, and so we kind of did a couple of potlucks on Thanksgiving Day.
Nice.
I hope you had a good time.
I did. Thank you. Very nice indeed.
Good. And it looks to me like you're in the luxury suite underneath the Oval Office there in the basement of the White House.
That's where I am.
So something must be going on.
Well, we just had a very late briefing, so I wasn't able to leave. So it was one of those days.
I see.
Yeah.
So what's the news for the day?
Well, we've got lots of it. The first one is that we've been told that as of noon today, the federal healthcare website had about 375,000 visitors. So by now, I'm sure it's over 400,000 is my guess.
As of noon today, since midnight last night?
Since midnight last night. That's what Jay Carney said, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the site is designed to handle 50,000. So some of those people were just browsing. They were just looking.
Sure.
But the site is designed to handle 50,000 people. So some people are getting messages telling them that they're going into the queue and that they will get an email and then they will come back later and be put to the head of the line. Also, Bloomberg's reporting that in November, 100,000 people signed up for health insurance coverage through the federal website, whereas in October there were about 26,000 people. So that's nearly four times the amount. Showing that even with really quite horrendous problems with the website in November, people persisted.
Well, that's kind of the curve that Massachusetts saw during the rollout of Romneycare, is that, you know, at first people are like, and then as you get closer and closer, they start going, hey, I better do this.
Right, exactly. And they anticipated a surge today, by the way. First of all, it's the first day since they got things up and moving. It's also Cyber Monday. They also were anticipating a surge as we get towards the 23rd of December, which is the deadline if you want insurance by January the 1st. Also, that's when the young people are really going to start signing up.
Now, really, the 23rd of December?
Yes.
I did not know that. How come I didn't know that?
They extended it.
Oh, okay. It used to be December 15th.
Yeah, they extended it to the 23rd.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically the day before Christmas.
That's right.
The day before Christmas Eve. You have to have signed up for insurance if you want it to start on January 1st. Now, what's this through March thing? You can sign up through March?
You can sign up through March, yes.
And then your insurance starts what, right away, or it doesn't start until sometime later?
I believe it starts in March. I'm not as clear about what happens through March. I've been more focused on the January date.
Okay.
But you can sign up later, but it doesn't start, obviously, in January if you delay.
Okay. I've been surprised, frankly. But one of my very, very best friends lives in New York City. He and his wife signed up through the exchange. One of my kids just signed up through the exchange. I you know, it's just people are just coming up to me randomly, people that I know, people that, you know, I know they've got no agenda, and saying, hey, I did it. It works. And I got a good deal. And I'm like, wow. Cool.
Yeah, people are having very positive experiences. The challenge they're having is on what's called the back end, which is where the information goes to the insurers, also where the Treasury Department interacts with the insurers,
right.
Kind of like the kitchen and the cash register at a restaurant. That's
right.
The working end of it.
Well, and that would make a certain amount of sense, because each health insurance company uses a different kind of computer system, and originally the idea was that the federal site was simply going to hand you off to the state, and the state would negotiate with three or four or five insurance companies, and, you know, it'd be, and the state would deal with those small number. But now you've got, because the Supreme Court, you know, let the states opt out of this thing, and because so many Republican governors have just said, hey, screw it, we're not gonna play, you've got the federal government now having to interact with all these, you know, in some cases rather obscure computer systems.
Yes. Yeah, so they've got to fix that, though, because people are getting wrong information.
Yeah, but they're dealing, in my opinion, what they're dealing with is Republican sabotage.
And I think they would agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Supreme Court today declined a couple of cases, very interesting ones. One of them rejected a petition from Liberty University, Jerry Falwell, which challenged the healthcare laws, employer coverage requirements, individual mandate, and contraception coverage requirements, said, no, we're not touching this. A lower court upheld the law in Liberty's case, so Liberty's was thrown out. Also declined to wade into a dispute between Amazon and Overstock and New York over sales tax collection.
Meaning that what happened? What was the precedent that remained in place?
Amazon and Overstock had challenged a New York law that forced the companies to collect sales tax on purchases made from the state.
Okay, so the bottom line is, if you live in New York State and you buy from Overstock or Amazon online, you do have to pay state tax.
That's correct.
And Amazon and Overstock have to collect it? Presumably?
Yes, basically. They have to collect those state taxes, and the Supreme Court decided to stay out of that, so that stays. So now Congress is going to have to wade into this or not, and Congress has really been messed up about this because they've been trying to pass laws and not passing laws, and this is going to really change online shopping enormously.
Well, you know, in the early days, it was let's just get this internet thing going, and so we're going to give everybody a tax break. But then now you've got apps where people walk into stores, they walk into Bed Bath and Beyond or something, you know, and see something that they like. Oh, I like that coffee maker. Point their camera at it, click it, and instantly order it from Amazon.
Right.
And pay no tax, whereas if they bought it right there in the store, they'd pay a sales tax.
Right, exactly.
And you've got states, in addition to Bed Bath & Beyond, or whoever, you know, I just picked them because I actually saw somebody do that in that store here in Washington, D.C. last week, that you've got states saying, hey, this isn't fair. I mean, what about us? That's very interesting. We'll see how this plays out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
GoatsForTheOldGoat.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, as the great Yogi Berra once said, it's deja vu all over again. No, seriously, right now, millions of Americans are still struggling to recover from the 2008 financial collapse, which was fueled by that housing bubble and then the derivative bubble, which then burst, and the Wall Street banksters were running around betting on risky mortgage-backed securities that they could sell to investors and make billions from. They could all do that because Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act had blown up rational banking regulations. As a result, we saw things like the so-called mortgage liar loans, where the, you know, loan companies would give you a house based on whatever they decided to make up. Or you. I mean, you could make things up, too, but it turns out that a lot of the mortgage companies were making things up. Banksters were able to turn billions of dollars in risky mortgages into trillions of dollars in derivatives, and then everything went to hell. So fast forward to today. And because of Dodd-Frank, there are no more liar loans, right? Banksters can't run the same scam they did during the housing crisis. So they found a new way to come up with real estate-backed securities that they can turn into derivatives that they can make billions of dollars in profits. And how? They've become landlords. I'm not making this up. Marilyn Volin points out over Tom Dispatch, in the past year and a half, banksters at Wall Street hedge funds, big banks, and private equity firms have purchased hundreds of thousands of mostly foreclosed houses across the country. Oh, it's a housing recovery. No, it's not. It's the banksters. Among the firms and big banks buying up America's real estate is the Blackstone Group, the largest private equity firm in the world. They out Mitt Romney, Mitt Romney. The Blackstone Group alone has bought nearly 40,000 homes across America, spending $7.5 billion in the process. For example, Blackstone bought 1,400 homes in Atlanta in one day and owns nearly 2,000 houses in the Charlotte, North Carolina metro area. So why are Blackstone and other Wall Street firms buying up foreclosed homes all across the country? It's simple. By renting these homes back to Americans and then securitizing America's home rental market, they can bundle up the rental payments the same way they used to bundle up mortgage payments and sell them to investors. And then they can sell insurance on them, and they can sell bets on the insurance, and they can sell bets on the bets, and they can sell bets on the bets on the bets. Sounds awful familiar, doesn't it? Blackstone alone has partnered with several of America's largest banks to bundle the rental payments of over 3,000 homes, and they're just getting started. This is a brand new effort. Last month, Blackstone released the first ever rated bond completely backed by securitized rental payments. And sure enough, investors rushed to get in on the action. When this latest get-rich-quick scheme by Wall Street blows up, see, they can't do it with mortgages anymore. We figured it out. We said, wait, that's too dangerous. You can't do that. Dodd-Frank, no, you can't do it. Oh, fine, we'll do it with rental properties. We don't need liar loans, right? We'll just do it ourselves. The big banks and the financial institutions, they're going to be just fine. You know, after 2008, they ended up bigger than they were before. And because they leverage these things so much, they have very little skin in the game, even though it seems like they own it all, right? But it's the mortgage payments, or the rental payments, rather, that are being securitized, not the value of the houses themselves. So they're always going to have that underlying value from which the derivative derives its value. So guess who faces the consequences when this thing blows up? You and me. Thousands of Americans are going to once again find themselves on the streets looking for a place to call home, and our economy is going to be shattered. We could see a housing and financial collapse that would make the Great Recession look mild. Now, yes, I did not identify this particular scheme in my book, The Crash of 2016. I did suggest that something like this, that they would figure out a way to do this. It just never occurred to me that this would be the way that they'd do it. But the basic premise of my book is that conservative lawmakers overreacted to progressive changes in America that took place in the 60s and 70s, and that overreaction, which included massive deregulation and tax cuts, opened the door to predators, particularly predatory banksters, to step in and wreak havoc on our economy. And as we see with Wall Street's new efforts to turn rental homes into cash cows, that door has not been closed. The predators are again up to their old tricks. Nothing has changed. Elizabeth Warren was right when she said that the system is rigged. And if we don't unrig the system quickly, we're going to see another disaster very, very soon. I mean, it might not be next week. It might not be next month. It might take a year or two. It probably is going to take a little while. From the time that they started securitizing mortgages, that was right around 2001, 2002 is when that really got under, you know, really got started. And it turned into a frenzy in 2005, 2006. I remember that really, really well. When all of a sudden all the ads you heard were, hey, you know, you can refinance your home, take the money out, do something, go take a vacation, go to Cancun, spend it. We need your debt so that we can sell your debt payments, or we can sell derivatives based on your debt payments. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. So, James, in Belvidere, Illinois, you think that we need an economy run by the consumer and the business need to be controlled by us, according to what Danielle tells me you told her. What do you mean by that? Welcome to the program, by the way, James.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, thank you. Sure, we need we need to own this economy as a nation and a people. With common interest.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't rely on somebody in business to do the proper thing for the consumer, for you and me as an individual, to protect our liberty, our freedom, our individuality. It's all gonna implode to the top, you know. Because they need more than, you know, we can tell them to say, hey, this is our market. If you don't want to participate in this market, if you don't want to pay the extra 5% tax, if you don't want to be constrained to
to the rules that we as a people created, you can, you know, there's other individuals there willing to take your void, to fill the void, other companies willing to step in and take the void.
Yeah.
Do you think
that's my point? You know, if these companies go, oh, well, you know, we can't pay more than $7.25 an hour. You say, okay, fine. Go out of business. Somebody will figure out a way to make hamburgers at a price people are willing to pay for, at a low price people are willing to pay for, while they're paying their employees $10 an hour.
Yeah, it's been a sellout for years and years, Tom.
Yeah.
Trickle down was a bad idea 30-plus years ago, and I knew that right away. I said, these people don't have to necessarily reinvest here. They can take their money and sit on it in a Swiss bank account,
yeah,
or they can invest and start a business overseas.
Remember when Ronald Reagan was trying to sell trickle-down economics and George W. Bush called it voodoo economics? And one of Bush's, this is when they were in during the primary, before he became the vice presidential nominee in 1980, and one of his advisors, I forget who it was, said, you know, they're peeing on you and telling you that it's raining, right? And that's what trickle-down economics is. And it's just incredible. James, thanks a lot for the call. You're right.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's raining. Well, maybe not. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lori in River Pines, California. You watching us on Free Speech TV on Dish Network. It says here you have a thoughtful position on the difference between term limits in the legislative and executive branch. Do I have
that
right?
Yes, thank you. I agree that term limits are not a good idea in the legislative branch. And here in California, I don't think it's been a good thing in the state Senate and the state assembly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is something in our human wiring that says, you know, oh, great and glorious leader, you know, take us where you will, when you have someone who is able to, you know, use their megalomania to kind of bring that out.
Right.
And so when it comes to executive positions of, you know, the where there's one person who's a leader, I think term limits are a good idea. We had a governor here named Arnold who, you know, became governor under somewhat questionable circumstances, and
mm-hmm.
the Sacramento Bee, the paper in Sacramento, you know, really glorified him, at least for a period of time. He, you know, might have gotten a little tarnished later on, but, you know, you could see a little bit of that, you know, you can, you're our leader, you take us where you will. And if there were not term limits, I think there could be that kind of person.
Don't you think, though, that when it came out that Arnold had been getting it on with his maid and they had a love child and all that kind of stuff, that he was toast with or without term limits?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that is true. At that point,
and that's that megalomania, isn't it? I mean, I think he qualifies right up at the top of the list for narcissistic personality disorder, or at least somebody who knows how to behave like one.
Oh, no question. I agree. And, you know, maybe he's the person I think of because he's kind of the proximate person here in California. But,
right.
You know, I think as we look back through history, do you think that there is that wiring in us?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think I think that in some people, and John Dean wrote a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, and points out that, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the population is actually just really wired to want to have a leader and to want to turn everything over to that leader, you know, and the Jim Joneses of the world and the Adolf Hitlers of the world, you know, and the religious and the political spheres exploit those people, no doubt about it. But I don't think that's the majority of us. And my concern, you know, I think George Washington set a wonderful precedent by refusing to run for a third term, because he certainly would have won it.
Yeah.
But And every president after him until FDR said, no, I'm not going to run for a third term. But they all had the ability to. And therefore, their party responded to them differently. There wasn't this idea of a lame duck presidency, a we know that you're going to be gone presidency. And I think that if Obama had the threat that he could wave over the Democrats in the Senate and the House when he wants to get things done, that he might run for a third term, that they might be behaving very differently. And I think that that would be a good thing. Lori, I do understand your concern, though. Thank you for the call. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I guess I'd like to make a quick comment about term limits. I think there's a lot to be said for somebody, since, you know, politics is a very experiential kind of thing. It's not something that you can take a test and prove that you're good at. And I really like my congressman, and not because he goes along with the status quo, but just the opposite. He's head of the Progressive Caucus, and I've supported him. I've worked in his campaign, and I would want to send him back or somebody like him
Keith Ellison?
Over and over again, because I think he does a good job, and he, you know, does the will of at least the people that live in his congressional district, because I think he won by 70% this last time.
Right.
But anyway, I wanted to talk about the concentration of wealth. I mean, I think it's not rocket science to say that it's just the opposite. The more wealth becomes concentrated, the less democracy there is. And it's been, you know, that's been the criticism of democracy, I think, from its, you know, inception. And I think that unless you do something to mitigate that, you are going to have a problem. You're going to have a less democratic society. You know, capitalism will work just fine in China, in India, in a lot of places, in Russia, you know, in a lot of places that are not terribly democratic. But I don't think that's a good thing. And I think most Americans would agree with me. So you do have to, you know, do something about redistributing wealth. I hate to say it, you know, but hey, history shows, and, you know, you can stand on your head and do flips, but it doesn't make it so. I mean, I guess you can tell a lie and keep drumming it into people's heads and give them no option, which people like Fox News and a lot of other wealthy people do seem to want to do, but it doesn't make it so. It's just not true. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. It's well said. John, thank you very much for the call. And this is where, again, it's our Supreme Court is the group who has told us that money has to stay in politics because money is the same thing as free speech, and free speech is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. Therefore, the money in your wallet is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and or the money in your Scrooge McDuck money bank, if you happen to be the Koch brothers, is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. And I think that's a crazy notion. Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Tom, great show. John, your last caller, well said, well said. I want to talk about outsourcing, but let me preface it with two quick things. One, I am a believer in God, but I believe you're right when we hear these guys reference scripture and they twist it. Technically, the apocalypse will be a man-made endeavor, which is probably tied to geoengineering and a lot of other things that affect the weather and so on. So anyway, misquote there on behalf of the Bible thumper. Mankind will play their part in the apocalypse.
Well, if you want to get biblical, you know, and I'm wary of doing that too much or too extensively, but if you want to get biblical, the all the warnings that are in the Bible about what, you know, about basically apocalypses are warnings against humans, you know, doing stupid things or engaging
right.
in hubris.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and then there is mention of the false prophets coming. Anyway, it's just a sidebar.
Yeah.
What you mentioned about rent was intriguing to me because I've been screaming this for a while about how this whole thing you can liken to the Great Depression. When immigrants came here and staked their claim, they were displaced, and there was a transference of wealth, and the properties were taken away. And one aspect of that, now that we see it again, that you might want to add to your list is the huge amount of cash flow that the buyers in today's markets will reap as they step in to these units. In other words, the rent, the monthly rent they collect,
right,
will be incredible amount of cash flow on top of them doing what they're doing, securitizing the rents and so forth.
Right. This is monopoly on steroids. Every time you go around the game, you have to pay rent. Right? Every time.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, according to one of the articles that I read about this, one of these companies that's doing this, if you're as much as a day late on your rent, they start eviction proceedings. They just do not mess around because, you know, they've got billions of dollars securitized on your little, you know, $300 a month rent payment.
And, you know, what's interesting, my wife and I were lucky enough to pick up some properties through the boom, and through the grace of God, we've hung on to them and modified them. But let me tell you, it was a full-time job, and I look back on it like, wow, we managed it.
Mm-hmm.
They were not cooperative. It was very hard to do. And I think that's the whole point. All the people that bought homes, you know, that wasn't what this was meant for. It was meant for the setup, for the wealthy to step in.
Oh, of course.
Banker buddy,
this is the thing about crashes that people don't get. You know, the prevailing wisdom is that when an economic crash happens, rich people jump out of windows. And it's the exact opposite. If anybody jumped out of a window, and those stories are almost certainly apocryphal about the great crash of 29. But if anybody jumped out of a window, it was some guy who was way down on the food chain who was a stock trader. It was not one of the millionaires or one of the billionaires, because, you know, some of them, yeah, lost a lot. But some of the largest fortunes in America were made during the 1930s, because the people who, you know, cash was king, was the phrase. The people who had money could buy up pretty much anything, and they could buy it for pennies on the dollar.
Sure.
And that'll
lead me to...
And they're still doing it, by the way.
And then, yeah, absolutely. And then finally to the point which initiated my call, what was this capitalism thing, then John even mentioned it. If we're going to take back anything, we have to acknowledge the loop's been broken. And the minute it was broken is when we somehow started nodding towards a global economy, and we bought
mm-hmm.
the story that
mm-hmm.
we need to be competitive in a global economy. And the answer to that is, no, we don't. We never had to be before. And this is the charade that's being perpetuated on the American people. So the problem is this. I don't want to shop at Walmart, but I sometimes have to because of my per capita income is so much lower now.
Yeah.
But if I go back in the 90s, I'd rather shop at the Jewel here in Chicago, the Dominick's that they're shutting down, because I made three times as much money. And I didn't care, Tom.
Yeah. Hey, Jay, I'm totally with you. And by the way, Shano tells me that he wants you to be the recipient of an autographed copy of The Crash of 2016. So let me put you on hold if you would like it. He's on line 3. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So Jay is going to get an autographed copy. He's the very first copy of autographed copy of Crash of 2016 that we've given away on this program. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Sandalwood says, maybe we should pool our resources and donate $1,000 to Free Speech TV and all of us descend on Tom and Louise in D.C. for dinner. Cool. That would be fun, actually. Get the chat room shows up, right? That would be a hoot. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, we've covered, you know, there's a lot. We've talked about a lot. And the Obamacare looks like it's working. And I this is very thought-provoking, frankly, to me, this idea of undoing the 22nd Amendment, I think it is, that you can't run for president more than twice, or can't hold the office more than twice, or whatever, however it's worded, that, you know, two terms, two full presidential terms. It was basically the anti-FDR amendment. Republicans have... They've done so much to screw up this country. But can just imagine how different things might be right now if President Obama could run for a third term. He might not be inclined to. But if he could use that as a threat, or, you know, if he wasn't weakened by the certain knowledge that he's not going to be around in a couple of years, that everybody has. I find that fascinating. Keith in Santa Rosa, California, you wanted to disagree about inflation?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me? Yeah. You were saying that inflation is driven by shortages.
Yes.
And that implies that prices are set by supply and demand, and I don't believe that.
Okay.
I think prices are set by what the market will bear. And, for instance, in 2008, the price of gasoline was driven up over $4 a gallon, mm-hmm. and I think that was to get it so that $3 a gallon would seem cheap.
I don't disagree, but see,
they moved what the market will bear.
Okay, interesting point. The frame you're using, though, is one in which, and this is where Reagan did such a disservice in 1982 when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, is one where a small number of companies basically control every industry. And so they get to figure out what the market will bear. I think I'd say the airline industries are doing the same thing. In fact, virtually every industry is doing the same thing, and set those prices based on that. The banksters, you know, with these obscene profits that they're making. But in a real free market economy, and I'm the one who's always yelling there's no such thing as a free market, but you know what I'm saying. If ExxonMobil decided to charge $4 an hour, a gallon for gasoline, and gasoline could be produced and sold profitably for $2 a gallon by BP, BP would do it. So it wouldn't just be a matter of what the market would bear unless there's collusion. And I would submit to you that there is collusion, and that collusion is felonious. It's a violation of federal law. And we're just not enforcing our laws, and it's one of the reasons why our economy is not working. So I guess I'm not entirely disagreeing with you, but you could also say, if you want to throw it back into my frame of shortages are what produce inflation, that what the oil companies are doing is they're withholding supply from the marketplace, even though they have plenty. They're withholding supply to produce an artificial shortage, which drives up the price. So you have inflation in the cost of gasoline. So are we saying the same thing?
Maybe. I'm not sure. Something that's been confusing me is last year the corn crop failed.
Right.
Basically. And the price of chicken feed went up like 50%.
Okay.
And this year the corn crop didn't fail, but it hasn't come back down.
Right. Well, you have basically three or four companies, ADM and Cargill, and there's one or two others that control probably 80% of that marketplace. So, you know, they've found a new price point. They've set themselves a new price point. So, you know, this again, our economy is so badly screwed up by Reaganomics that even fundamental kind of Econ 101 stuff doesn't seem to work the way it should. But the big point that I was making, the myth that I wanted to puncture, is the one that Ron Paul and these guys run around saying, is that if the government, quote, prints money, and they identify federal borrowing as printing of money, and it's really not, but in any case, that if the government is printing money or borrowing money, that is producing inflation. And the government does intentionally produce inflation, or at least the Fed does, by altering our money supply. But they have a very carefully calibrated control of that. And when it, you know, and they want it, you know, they want there to be an inflation of 1 or 2 or 3% maximum per year, so that basically the government can pay off old debts with new money that's worth less. There's a certain stability to an economy that works like that. But then you get something like the Arab oil embargo that it produces a real shortage that echoes through the economy. And that's something that the Fed just can't deal with. I mean, you know, if Paul Volcker had to crank interest rates all the way up to what, 14%, 13%? I forget what it was, the prime rate was at, in order to wring out that inflation that was caused by that oil price increase. It was not caused by the federal government. It wasn't caused by borrowing. Federal borrowing, and that's the point that I wanted to make, is that federal borrowing does not cause inflation.
Okay.
You know, another point is that when prices go up and then they don't come back down, I think there's a disaster capitalism aspect to that, too.
I agree. And I think that what you and I are saying is pretty much the same thing in somewhat different words, and that Naomi Klein in her book Disaster Capitalism, that's not the title of the book, that's just the phrase that she came up with.
Right.
But in any case, in her book that
shock
identified
doctrine.
Pardon?
The shock
doctrine. That's right. That's the title of the book. I think that she did a brilliant job of pointing that out. Kevin, thank you for the call. Very thoughtful call. I appreciate it. Euless in Jewel Ridge, Virginia. Hey, Euless.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
Just fine. Love you to talk there about oil and gas.
Okay.
I live right in the middle of place here. I live in Southwest Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend, he works for the gas wells. There's probably 3,000 wells within this 4 or 5 county area.
Wow.
And they fracking, and it's really detrimental to the environment a lot.
How so? What are you noticing?
Well, I have an old farm pond here, and the water was gone. And they continuously hauling water to keep the gas producing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you Google it, you know, that's our biggest export is gas and oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they want you to think different to keep the prices artificially inflated, you know.
Well, and that's the conversation I was having, you know, a caller or two ago, is you're absolutely right. The biggest export from the United States is refined petroleum products. And if we put the Keystone Pipeline through, it's gonna explode from that.
Oh, yes, that's what they want.
Yeah.
And that'd be another thing to the environment, right through the middle of the country. They want to refine it and then put it through the Gulf so, you know, they can take it out that way to the
that's
world
right.
market.
Yeah, what I don't understand is why all these rocket scientists out there who are all gung-ho for the Keystone XL pipeline, why none of them are asking the simple question, why does it have to end at the Gulf of Mexico? I mean, you know, if it's oil for America, right? American independence, oil for America. Why not end it in the middle of America? Why not end it in Kansas?
Well, the refineries are in Oklahoma, and it's for the world market. It's not for America.
Of course it is. It's for export. Of course it is. But these guys somehow they don't even realize they haven't put two and two together yet. Euless, thanks a lot for the call, and I'm sorry to hear that Jewel Ridge, Virginia is being basically raped by the natural gas companies. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. You got a minute to the break. Marty, you've got a new name for Reaganomics?
Yeah, for Reaganomics, yes. Instead of trickle-down economics, let's call it tinkle-on economics.
Tinkle-on. There you go. Yeah, I used to make the joke that, you know, it's they call it trickle-down economics, and all it does is produce a nation of peons. And, you know, sometimes it takes a minute, but people eventually get that. And, yeah, tinkle on economics. What's so astounding to me, Marty, is the persistence of this. Here we are 32 years. We've experimented with this for 32 years. And young people, you know, will call this program or will come on my TV show and say, oh, it works wonderfully. It's, you know, Reaganomics. It's just the greatest thing. And actually, it's more likely to be young people, because anybody who's old enough to remember what America was like before Reagan remembers that we used to actually have a middle class. You know, it used to be different. Marty, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As Shano points out, even the Pope gets this, which, of course, is why they're running around going, oh, the president, he's closing the Vatican embassy. No, he's not. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Madison, Illinois. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good evening, Doctor. Can you hear me?
I can. How are you?
Oh, great. And Marty's great. I used to live in Upper Green. I got a party with that cowboy.
Mm.
But the thing I wanted to bring up, two things. First thing, the flags behind you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's probably people who wonder. But I noticed, now, my understanding is that these flags fly when they're in session. Is that true?
I don't know.
Am I mistaken?
I honestly, I don't know the rules of when they fly the flags and when they don't.
Because I believe the one on the right is the House of Representatives, and it's never airborne.
Oh, interesting. I can only... It's actually a projected picture behind me. It's a live picture. It's a live shot of the Capitol, but it's projected behind me, so I can't. I only see it. Oh, really? Okay, Jim is telling me that the House flag is actually out of the view of our shot. It's blocked by the dome. So is that the Senate flag, Jim?
The Senate flag would be the West Wing or the Oval Office.
So is this the Senate flag right here, Jim? That's in front of the rotunda. Okay, that's in front of the rotunda. And then the house flag you can't see because, okay, all right. Yeah, I'm sorry, John, I'm not more informative here on this.
I was hoping you might be able to resolve that, but maybe in the future.
Yeah, I think it's a live shot from, I think it's taken from the Hart office building, the Senate office building of the Capitol right across the street from, which we're about three blocks from. So it's not a shot from our building. It's a shot from a couple buildings over. But, it is a real live shot. So, and the thing that baffles me is how often the flags are at half staff. I guess, though, that any member of Congress, no matter how old they are or how long ago they served, when they die, they lower the flags to half staff because they're at half staff an awful lot, it seems. And at first I thought that was just because, John Boehner was Speaker of the House or something. But, it's actually something much more, pedestrian. So
the more important thing I wanted to get your take on was there's so many things going wrong right now with this country. Okay. And everything seems to keep leading back to the Supreme Court. And I'm wondering, why is it that their lifetime terms and can't the Senate appoint or at least let's say anoint and let the citizenry elect? And that way I think maybe we'll get a better reflection of our country.
Yeah, let me refer you to Article 3. Let me refer you to Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, where it says the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. The Constitution of the United States says that the Supreme Court is subject to regulation and what they can decide upon is subject to exceptions determined by Congress. Now, this is what FDR tried to do. FDR tried to say when he tried to, quote, pack the court in 1937, that any member over 70 years old of the Supreme Court, that all of them together, I think there were four or five of them at the time who were over 70, they all together became one vote. And then he would add additional people to bring it up to nine. So Congress can fix this, but they have been unwilling to do it. Apparently above the blue box on the full screen shot, for those of you who are looking at it on TV, that's the Senate flagpole, according to Jim. And the one on the, if you're looking at the TV screen on your left, is the rotunda flag. And I don't know what the other one is. Oh, it's on the other side. The House one is on. That's the Senate one. I see. The Senate one is the one in between. Anyhow, we are dealing with strange things here. Douglas in Minneapolis. Hey, Douglas.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, I just wanted to say that that the people that work in Washington for the they've got it in these big corporations. They've made a mistake, and they're poor students of history because during the Russian Revolution. What happened to the leaders of that country? They killed them all because the people got so poor that they just, the only resort they had left was something like that, and it's a shame that they don't study these things. And in England, the same thing happened, or was it the French? Where
it was France.
Queen said, let them eat cake.
Yeah, Marie Antoinette.
Well, Walmart is basically saying to their employees, you can eat cake, we don't care.
Yeah, and, or you can eat Twinkies.
Right. I think that the people who are protesting Walmart should go to the Walton's house and protest. Doing it in front of Walmart isn't going to help.
I'm very wary about personalizing these things for people who live fairly private lives. The Koch brothers are out there publicly, making statements and funding things and whatnot, and I think it's appropriate to call them out when they do. A lot of the members of the Walton family, I think, they just want to be quiet billionaires. What we need to be doing instead of going after the Walton family, or for that matter, the Koch brothers, is we need to be involved with our political process. Because the only reason the Koch brothers have all that money, and the only reason the Walton family, frankly, has all that money, is because our political process has reorganized our economy in such a way that allows it to happen, that allows that kind of wealth to accumulate at the top and allows those folks to be as politically active with their money as they are and allows them to also pay a lower tax rate than most working Americans do or many working Americans do. And that's where our outrage should be directed. And that outrage should take the form of let's participate in the political system, whether it's from the inside, showing up and becoming a precinct committee person, and volunteering with your local Democratic Party or Republican Party or Green or Libertarian or whatever it may be on the inside, or on the outside saying, I'm going to join MoveToAmend.org or Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, or one of the other fine organizations out there that does stuff on the outside that's pushing, OurFuture.org is another great organization, Roger Hickey's organization and Bob Borisash, that is speaking, truth to power. We really need to be supporting these groups. Free Speech TV, freespeech.org. Douglas, thanks a lot for the call. Jay in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. I wanted to point something else, but your last caller just got me thinking. I'm a 44-year-old veteran who went back to school in the new Obama GI Bill, mm-hmm. and it's been great. One of the problems that I have is I'm a business major, and I keep getting in trouble because I quote you, Ravi Batra, and Robert Reich, and I even had one professor refer to your book, Sprued, as a slander piece, and another book by Ravi Batra, The Myth of Free Trade, again, as not credible sources.
Right.
And so I asked, why do we keep teaching the Chicago School of Economics here, mm-hmm. and this trickle-down economics, when we see that it's failed? And he had no answer for me. And I said, well, who decides the curriculum? Is it you? Is it the school? Is it the dean of economics here? Or what? And
donors.
I kept pushing. Yeah. Well, it is a private university. And so when I kept pushing it, another professor advised me to just graduate and not rock the boat.
Right.
But my other thing was, it was regarding the Bitcoin. When you were talking about the bubble,
mm-hmm.
The new derivatives and the rent, the Bitcoin, I just recently found out about what it is and so forth, and it's an unregulated or a currency that's not backed by any country.
Right.
So do you see the banksters eventually getting into this and saying, hey, there's a currency out there that's not regulated, we can do whatever we want, and let's jump
I doubt it.
And
I doubt it. The banksters want to be involved with countries so that they can always fall back on those countries, because countries have the power to tax. Bitcoins, in my opinion, are the new Dutch tulip craze. And it's been a long time since we've seen, since the Dutch tulip craze, where tulips were selling for the equivalent in today's dollars of $17,000 a piece, that a year or two earlier had been a dollar a piece in Holland, because everybody thought this is an investment that's just always consistently going to get, worth more and more and more and more. There is a bubble forming around Bitcoins, in my opinion, and the reason why it's different than the kind of bubbles that form around, governmental things or currencies, is that there is no government behind it. There is no intrinsic store of value. The United States backs the U.S. dollar not just by our full faith and credit, but by our trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars worth of assets. And there's nothing backing bitcoins, just like there was nothing backing the Dutch tulips. So I think this, or like the South Sea Company, the South Sea Company is another variation on that. If you look up those bubbles, the South Sea bubble and the Dutch tulip bubble, I think you're going to see what we're looking at with bitcoins. I hope I'm wrong, but I think some people are going to get really badly burned. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and information you're not going to hear from the corporate-owned media. Plus, corporations are people. Does that mean they have religion now, too? Bradley Smith at the Center for Competitive Politics says so. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.